My name is Gregory Day from the Weekly Portland Podcast at pdxpodcast.com. This is an encore presentation of an interview I had with Colin O'Brady. He's just been announced as a TEDx Portland speaker for 2017. Colin is an endurance athlete, a Timbers fan, and has set several world records. Let's meet Colin O'Brady.
He did it on Friday of May 27th of this year. Professional endurance athlete Colin O'Brady became a two-time world record holder. Colin became the fastest person to complete the Explorer's Grand Slam mountaineering challenge. He climbed the seven summits and skied the last degree to the North and South Poles in uninterrupted succession, setting the world record in just 139 days, as well as the Seven Summits record in 132 days.
I'm on the summit of Mount Everest, top of the world. No words can describe.
Colin hopes that his record-breaking performance across two poles and seven continents will inspire today's youth to dream big, set goals, and lead active, healthy lives. So I caught up with Colin in his home. We discussed reaching the peak of Denali, his final destination on this grand, grand adventure.
Standing on the top of Denali, North America's highest summit, on May 27th was an incredible feeling. After traveling all over the world, climbing the tallest mountain on each of the seven continents, the North and South Pole, and then to, on that moment, have set two world records. It's just an incredible moment, incredible feeling. So much had gone into it. And amazing that it just so happened that the last mountain on the journey was close-ish to home comparatively from where I had been all over the world. So just a tearful moment. I think you saw the film. I kind of dropped to my knees and I'm crying, but it's freezing outside, so my tears are freezing on my face, and I'm just so relieved. So incredible moment for sure. Denali is a huge mountain, 20,000 feet, but still 10,000 shorter than Everest, almost, give or take. So, yeah, you're talking about nearly three Mount Hoods stacked on top of each other to reach to the summit of Everest. Yeah.
That's a great way to put it, three Mount Hoods.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Now, I do want to ask you, I read about this on your Wikipedia page, and you mentioned it quite a few times on the Rich Roll podcast. Brian Gelber, he is your mentor. Where would you be without this guy?
You know, Brian Gelber is a huge instrumental influence in my life. I met him. I had moved to Chicago not long after being severely burned in a fire about 9 years ago. And I moved to Chicago to start working as a commodities trader, actually. And I met Mr. Gelber through that industry. He runs another firm, not the firm I was working for. I know I'm friends with his family. And right after I won the Chicago Triathlon, he kind of came into my life and he said, "This is an incredible story. You know, I'm proud to know you and I'd love to help, support the next phase of what you do." And so he was actually my very first sponsor for a triathlon, which turned into a triathlon career where I, over the last 6 or 7 years, raced on 25 countries, six different continents, raced all over the world, representing the U.S., the U.S. national team. So it's just an honor. And he definitely helped get my start in that, help support that, and was one of the main supporters of this project. So really, I owe so much to him in terms of support he's shown me, not just financially, but just as a mentor, someone who, knows about high performance. This guy is just an incredibly renowned a businessman, and I feel so fortunate to have him as a mentor in my life.
Well, how did you hear about this story? Did you read about it in the paper, or were we talking about it at the water cooler?
I was actually friends with his daughters originally.
So you're coming on to his daughter.
Yeah, no, well, actually, one of my best friends is married to his daughter, so same group of friends.
Definitely not coming on to her.
Yeah, same group of friends, and we got introduced, and coincidentally, the day that I won the Chicago Triathlon, they having a barbecue at their house, and so I was there, and it's kind of like, so what did you do today? Oh, I won the Chicago Triathlon.
Are you serious? That's how it began, this?
Yeah, so that was 7-8 years ago, and that's really where we first connected, and then, like I said, just as an amazing tribute to his generosity and vision, and for me was stepped in and wanted to help and support my athletic ambitions, and here we are. I just had dinner with him in Chicago a month or so ago, and it was fun to be sitting there 6 or 7 years in the future going, hey, we set 2 world records together. So it's just an amazing, and he's been with me every step of the journey, and I couldn't be more appreciative of that.
So what exactly does a mentor do for you besides give you a check? I mean, what else did he help you with on your journey?
You know, one of the things that's really interesting is that I've learned through all of this is that high performance in any different sphere, I think there's so many similarities. So in my case, that's sport. In his case, that's business and commodities trading. But whether that's art or music or, a different type of sport, not just endurance sport, but maybe, track running or swimming, all these different things. There are so many threads in common. And so even though Mr. Gelber is not a mountaineer, he's climbed to the figurative top of Everest in the business world. I mean, there's literally books written about the guy called Market Wizards. He's featured in that book as one of the most renowned people in that industry. So he was able to mentor me in a way of just what it means to high perform, what goes into that. Times when I had setbacks, injuries or whatnot as I was training as a triathlete, bad moments, I'd come to him and he would say, oh, Colin, I'm sure you look at me, you think I'm this successful guy. Like, let me tell you about when I was cutting my teeth in this industry and a trade went the wrong way and I lost all my money and I didn't know what I was going to, all those moments, and to help to coach me through those moments and understand that there's an ebb and a flow, and to get to true mastery and true high performance in something, you have to go through the hard times. And so to have somebody who understands that and who's lived that themselves, even though it's in sort of a different arena, was so valuable to have as a mentor in a mentor relationship. So much about the inspiration behind this project was so much more than just me going out there to set a world record. Of course, without a doubt, I had my own personal ambitions, been a high-level athlete most of my life, and to set a world record, of course, is the pinnacle of that, decades worth of being an athlete. But more so than that, with this project, my hope was to inspire kids out there to explore the outdoors, to get outside, get out behind the TV and the video games, and, play and run and live active, healthy lives. Unfortunately, in our country, it's an epidemic of, obesity in children, being unhealthy, unhealthy lifestyle. And I really think that certainly for me, and I know certainly for others, as you live a more healthy lifestyle, it's not just to become a professional athlete like me. It's just that can help to lead to success in many realms, whether that's, being active can help you get better grades, And so we kind of built this entire campaign with this project around sharing this story with those ethos. And one of the most fun parts about it, as you mentioned, was for me, I went to a number of elementary schools and spoke to them before this project and said, hey, look, I've set myself a big goal here. I hope I achieve it. I don't know if I'm going to, but I'm going to go out and try to do this great thing. And hopefully you guys can follow along. And a number of schools and administrators and teachers got really engaged with the project to the point where they were checking our social media and blog every single day, following along. And it was incredible that school kids were sending me messages in real time, on the side of Everest on my sat phone. I could get text messages and little messages from them. And, that really, my hope was to inspire them, but they really inspired me at the end of the day to keep going. Yeah. Times were tough out there, but I knew that all these, fourth, fifth, sixth graders were cheering me on. It was like, I want to make them proud of me for what I was doing. And so it's been fun to come back successful after this project and revisit with some of those kids. And it's something that I continue to do to share my story and hopefully inspire them to know that, when you have confront setbacks in your life, but as long as you have goals out there and you keep pushing forwards, we can do incredible things, and that really starts, I think, with an active and healthy lifestyle.
Yeah, well, you're young. I mean, you really resonate, I think, with younger children. And are you considered a millennial? Are you?
I think technically, I was actually having this conversation with a friend of mine the other day. I think technically I am, although I think I'm on the older age of that. So I'm 31 years old now. So I think technically I am still a millennial, although I think people generally think that people 10 years younger than me when they use millennial. So I'm kind of in between.
Right. Well, that's what I think as far as relatable to. I mean, you have this killer Instagram account. I mean, that thing's blowing up.
Yeah, yeah. You, for all the listeners out there, check it out, @beyond_72. You know, it's for us, so much of was fun of this project was to be able to share this story, you know, share it far and wide. So, of course, we were posting every single day, you know, from the summit of Everest, from the North and South Pole to show people the world. So you can, you know, if you go check out the Instagram account, you can see photos from that. And but still, you know, I'm still having fun sharing the story, you know, and of course, as I do things in the future, I'll be sharing it on there. But still, periodically, I'm still posting and coming through my old photos and things from this project and finding amazing images to share that haven't been seen yet from these places. So.
Right, and they truly are amazing. I mean, some of these images, they're just incredibly popular too.
Yeah,
you kind of an Instagram hit.
Yeah, Instagram's been Instagram's been a great format for sharing this project. So much of what was amazing for me to personally experience some of these places was just the beauty of it. You know, it's incredible to see Antarctica. You know, the North Pole. These are places that you know I can only dreamed of seeing in my life, and so fortunate to get to experience. So to be able to share that and these beautiful mountain vistas with other people following along has been so much fun for me.
You know, there was a very short clip of you on the top of Everest, and you were totally exhausted, but you said, I'm at top of the world, top of the world. Do you even remember that now?
You know, that is kind of a little bit in a haze, I got to be honest. Funny enough, so you saw that clip, but there's actually an outtake blooper right before that where I have an oxygen mask on, you know, being on the summit of Everest, and I pulled my oxygen mask off to take that clip right when I got to the sun. I said, I think I had my GoPro out, and I said, I'm on the top of the... And then I actually ran out of breath. There was so little oxygen up there that I had to sit down, put my oxygen mask back on, and then go for take two to actually get the get it all out. But no, it was fun. And you know, speaking of social media, we also Snapchatted along this whole time. I guess that makes me closer to the millennial generation.
Yeah.
But I had to have a younger millennial actually teach me how to use the app. But it was a great platform for sharing this. And I was actually, that clip is actually the very first Snapchat ever to be taken from the summit of Everest. So I'm told by the folks at Snapchat. So that was a pretty fun way to share that as
Yet another record. Yet another record. Now, I'm going to get a bit philosophical here. I mean, you were on the ITU circuit. You started to feel that maybe, you know, something was missing. Now you've completed this incredible journey. Do you feel like you found it?
Yeah, you know, I think part of my whole journey through sport has been, you know, complete with its own ups and downs, you know, from being a high-level swimmer and soccer player in my youth here in Oregon to going on to swim at Yale University, and then after that turning professional in triathlon after having this severe burn injury that really set me back. And then going on now to set this world record in mountaineering. You know, all of those things have compounded and built to this moment for sure. You know, it goes without saying for me, one of the things that's been most special and what I've learned throughout my athletic career is, you know, high performance is an amazing thing. A friend of mine shared with me this after she had won a gold medal. She had said, you know, the gold medal is an amazing thing. And of course, for me being an athlete, I, you know, admire Olympic gold medal, you know, higher than anything in the world, really, in terms of achievement in sport. But it really matters who you bring there with you. So it's that whole journey. Yeah. It's, you know, if you sacrifice all your friendships and your community and all these things to attain this high performance, then that moment's going to be pretty lonely standing on the top of this podium. So, you know, I've always tried to take that lesson with me. So for me, this world record, you know, standing on top of that, you know, where we opened this interview, standing on top of that moment in Denali, setting this world record was an incredible moment. Yeah. But what made it so much more incredible was – the kids who had followed along that were inspired by the project, the people following along on Instagram and, you know, congratulating me, but also sharing with me their dreams, their visions, their goals. You know, Jenna Bisaw, who's my fiance, who was the executive director of our project and continues to work tirelessly on all of the aspects of the logistics and things day in and day out. My family, you know, my friends, just to have all that support and love there. You know, I was the one standing on top of the mountain, but was doing it all together. Okay. So to me, learning that lesson over time, and to answer your question, is I do really feel like something very much came together there for me, because it was a personal achievement, but really was an achievement of a group of people that believed in this idea and supported it.
Yeah, and you know, you've got all these elementary kids that were following you, and they're going to grow up, and that's going to affect them. So there are residual effects that are out there in the world. You've affected their lives. How does that feel?
Yeah, you know, that's always been the hope. You know, it's humbling to think that, but it's fun as well. You know, one of the things that I love so much, you know, I really enjoy public speaking, and there's been some.
You really do. You're really good at this. You should take my job.
Yeah, right. I enjoy public speaking, and there's been some amazing opportunities in terms of public speaking in the corporate setting, to groups of people, and you know, that I love doing that. But certainly, there's something that's extra special about being able to speak to, you know, kids. You know, when I go in and speak to them, you know, I leave always with a smile, you know, peeled to my face, just ear to ear, because I get so much energy from that environment. And it's fun too, as I've gone and told other people, my peers, about, you know, hey, you know, I'm doing all the speaking in schools and I really enjoy it. Almost everyone that I've talked to my age has a story about, they might not remember the person's specific name, but they say, you know, this professional skier came to my elementary school in fourth grade and I got a try on their silver medal, or this astronaut came in and told me about the time he went to space. So, you know, really it's something that sticks with people. So if I can have that little bit of impact, you know, like I said, it's humbling and an amazing thing. And certainly I feel very worth of my time.
You've got a very interesting background. Your mother, Eileen, ran for mayor. She was one of the co-founders of New Seasons. You grew up eating kale voluntarily or not?
Yeah, there's no doubt. You know, so my mother being a co-founder of New Seasons Market with my stepfather and my dad is actually an organic farmer in Hawaii, and before that had also worked in the natural foods industry. So I basically have a lineage of people who believe in, you know, healthful eating. And I think that there were times as a kid that I probably rebelled against that a little bit. But certainly as I became a young adult and got it on my own for the first time, I realized how fortunate I was to have those role models in my life and to have that be the quote-unquote norm. Because for far too many people, the access to that, or the understanding or the value of that, you know, is not prevalent, you know, as seen by the obesity epidemic in this country with so much processed food. So I'm so thankful now that my parents really, you know, raised me that way. And I definitely attribute a lot of my success to having those role models and people around me supporting me in that way, and my family, to, you know, first and foremost.
Yeah, I am curious. Now, Eileen was there during your burn incident. We haven't talked about that at all, but it had a great effect on your life. 25% of your body was burned, mostly your legs and feet. Yeah. You jumped in the ocean after getting kerosene on your body. For people who haven't listened to that other podcast, can you just give us a brief overview? And how was your mother supportive and helped you progress?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, you kind of nailed the first part of the story there. You know, I was on a beach in Thailand and I was severely burned. You know, ended up in a series of Thai hospitals for a couple of months. You know, started out with a tiny little nursing shack, essentially, and then transferred via moped, back of a pickup truck, boat to another island where I underwent 8 surgeries, all the while coming out of surgery and having a cat running around my bed in the ICU and being told, you know, I may never walk again normally. Not the place you want to find yourself, to say the least.
You know, you're smiling right now talking about this, but it's a horrific accident.
Yeah, no, it really was. But, you know, my mother, like you said, was really a huge part of you know, making, you know, getting me through that moment. One of my childhood best friends, David Boyer, was there when it happened. And then a few days later, my mother flew over from the United States and really sat by my bedside, you know, throughout my entire recovery. You know, being told you may never walk again is a pretty tough diagnosis for anyone, but particularly for me at age 22, having been an athlete most of my life.
What year was this?
This was 2008. Yeah, January of 2008. So 8.5 years ago now, I guess. And, you know, my mom said, you know, hey, let's set a goal. Let's keep your mind active.
Your mother said that.
Yeah, she said to me, she didn't say what the goal was going to be, but she was just trying to kind of keep my mind active and engaged and keep me excited about, you know, being alive, really. And so she admits now she was more or less placating me, more or less just trying to keep me happy in some regard. But I set this goal of I want to complete a triathlon. I'd never done that before. I've been a collegiate swimmer, but never biked or run or anything like that. And so, you know, she said, hey, let's set a goal. And I set this goal of completing a triathlon one day. And that's really what I focused on throughout my whole recovery process, which was a long year of learning how to walk again. And eventually walking became jogging became running, and 18 months after my accident, I ended up, you know, winning the Chicago Triathlon, which certainly changed my life. You know, in comes Mr. Gelber, and I turned professional in triathlon, and the rest is history. But, you know, having my mother there, having someone in sort of my darkest moments still come at me with this really positive message of you can overcome that was so instrumental to me. And so much of what I talk about with school kids, you know, with my corporate speaking, you know, what I really embody is that no matter what, I hope everyone, no one out there listening, you know, ever has to confront a burn injury where you can't walk, but everyone has setbacks in their life, you know, whether big or small, that's just part of life. And it's really easy to have that decision point where you go, I can't go on, or I can't do it, or I give up. But, you know, believe me when I say, if you can press on, if you can keep believing in yourself, set yourself a goal and move forward, you'll be amazed that those dark times might turn into the brightest times of your life. So looking back, you know, I never would have wanted to be burned in a fire, but I also don't think that I'd be a 2-time world record holder if I hadn't been burned in that fire. So there's a sweet irony to that. And it just shows that, you know, when one door closes, another one opens, or there's always opportunities right around the next corner.
You are very close with Jenna. And in fact, you have an amazing race audition video on YouTube.
Wow, that's funny you found that. That's hilarious. I love it. Yes, we did audition for The Amazing Race a few years ago before I'd done any of this. But if anyone from The Amazing Race is out there listening, we still love a shout-out. We haven't gotten a call back yet, but I think we would be pretty good for the show.
Colin then described his time at the Noosa training camp in Australia, a period of his life in which he was guilty of overtraining and had to overcome that obstacle.
Yeah, you know, that was a tough point in my athletic career for sure. You know, it was early on in my professional triathlon career. I think it was my second full professional season, and I had the opportunity to train on a team with some of the best athletes in the world, you know, world champions, yeah. Olympic medalists. It was a dream come true for me to be training with, like I said, some of my idols in the sports world. But of course, comes with that, you know, I was a young up-and-comer and really eager to just push as hard as I can. And unfortunately, I may have pushed a little bit too far. And like you said, become overtrained and have my testosterone levels drop. So
did you get them measured? Did you get your testosterone?
I got back. Noosa is in Australia, but I got back to the United States and got those measurements taken. And the doctor said, your testosterone level is that of an average of a 93-year-old man. So I think that there's a problem here. So unfortunately, I had to kind of call it quits, not for the whole season, but for a few months to kind of stop training, to recover, and to, you know, trying to kind of sleep well, get my nutrition back under line. And it was really tough for me. You know, it was definitely really hard, but also an incredibly valuable lesson at that moment, particularly because, you know, what I attribute the success of this world record project to is I was out there for 139 days in some of the harshest environments in the world, you know, minus 40 temperatures at the poles, you know, high altitude on Mount Everest, you know, flying from country to country. And the success of this project, this world record project, really depended upon me being able to be consistent over time, to be able to not just put together one huge summit day, but to put together 139 days of consistency. So when my, you know, when I was overtrained and my testosterone dropped to this level, I realized that there is a limit to my capacity and I needed to conserve and figure out how to recover in between mountains. So although, again, you know, just like the burn accident, this moment where I overtrained was one of the darker moments in my athletic career. There was huge lessons to be, you know, benefited from that when I've learned. And so being able to recover from that, learn my body a little bit more, learn my boundaries, learn about recovery, really, I think, aided me in this world record project to be able to put together 139 days straight together all over the world and pushing myself.
Did you hire a nutritionist, or you just have that background to where you know what to eat, you know what to do?
Yeah, you know, I've worked with different people over time, but not for this specific project. You know, I did. I always do monitor my blood work, you know, before and after this project. As an athlete, that's something after being overtrained, it's something I've monitored pretty closely. So every 3 to 6 months, I'll go in just to like test certain levels and things, make sure everything's looking good. But yeah, you know, the nutrition side of it has sort of, you know, over time become intuitive for me. I know what works well for my body. But one of the toughest things about the world record was it's one thing to know what works well for your body when everything's 100% under your control. So when you're under your own roof, you can eat, you know, pretty much what you want to eat. But I was in
variables in there,
you know, throw 7 continents, the North and South Pole in there, different cultures, different foods, the climates, you know, the ability that you have to carry it all on your back or pull it in a sled behind you in the case of the poles. I obviously wasn't able to quite eat the exact perfect diet, so figuring out how to work within those constraints but to still be healthy and fuel my body correctly was really important.
So I wanted to review the entire trek with Colin one by one. So we started out with the South Pole.
Well, first we're gonna go in sequence here.
All right.
The South Pole.
Yeah.
Any memorable moments?
Yeah, so the South Pole, you know, both polar expeditions require, for this world record, the Explorer's Grand Slam, you have to cross the last degree of latitude of each of the poles. So I was taken in a plane and literally dropped off at the 89th degree with me and a couple of my partners who I was with, and there was just the white abyss surrounding us and an average of minus 35, minus 40 degree temperatures. And at that time of the year in Antarctica, the sun...
Was this in January?
Yes, yeah. So it was early January. I arrived at the pole on January 10th.
And you're thinking, what have I got myself into?
Yeah, I mean, those were the first steps of this whole project. So I'm suffering through my first couple of days, and I'm thinking, not only is this really challenging, but I've got another 150-some days left, or 139 in this case. I didn't know how many days at that point more of this was going to have to be. So that was a stark realization at that moment. But, you know, it's incredible out there. Antarctica is an amazing place, so pristine, so untouched, so vast, and the sun is up 24 hours a day that time of the year. So you're literally, it feels like high noon. So you got to go to bed after a long day of pulling your sled 8, 9, 10 hours out there in the, you know, dire cold, cook some food and go to sleep.
Yeah.
But it still is like high noon. So you just got to tell yourself, you're looking at your watch like, okay, no, it's like it's 11 p.m. It's time to go to sleep. So there's just the whole kind of psychological aspect of that was pretty
sort of throw you off a little bit.
Oh, for sure, for sure. It's a whole nother universe out there. And even though I was with a few other people, it's so cold and you can't have any of your skin exposed. So full face mask, buffs, everything covering your face. There's not, you can't really talk to one another. I mean, other than really basic level of communication, and just because it's too hard and too cold and you can't, you know, pull your mouth and expose it, it'll literally freeze.
Yeah.
And so, you know, one of the things about that is that it ends up being this super solitary pursuit. All you can see is white in every direction. There's no real sensory input and there's no one to talk to. And you're out there, you know, dragging a 100-pound sled day after day after day.
Instagram pictures out there?
No, there were some. I was able to, you know, one of the things we did is we took my sat phone and was able to send images back through my sat phone. So we could send a few kind of lower resolution pictures, but enough to kind of tell the story.
Yeah. Wow.
So, yeah, so that was the South Pole. And then next up was Mount Vincent, which is also in Antarctica. It's the tallest mountain in Antarctica.
Yeah.
And so I, after reaching the South Pole, was picked up in a plane and flown back and then dropped off at the base camp of Mount Vincent. No. and the base camp of Mount Vinson. And that Mount Vinson is 16,000 feet, which in terms of the seven summits is one of the smallest, but that's still a big mountain. You're still talking 2,000 feet higher than Mount Rainier, you know, 5,000 feet taller than Mount Hood. You know, it's a big mountain for sure. And that expedition was also tough. You know, it's not the most technically demanding mountain of the seven summits. But, you know, the day that we went to the summit, the wind actually kicked up to about 20, 30 miles per hour, which is pretty high, but not incredibly high for a big mountaineering challenge. But when the ambient temperature is already minus 40, that makes the wind chill, you know, minus 70 at that point. So it is a pretty an intense amount of cold, and making sure you don't get frostbite, and that is really important out there.
You must have looked like the Michelin man, all wrapped up.
Yeah, of course, lots of down jackets and big gloves and big boots and all that sort of stuff. And one of the things that, even with the amount of clothes you put on to keep yourself warm, it's all about keeping your body moving. You know, when you're moving, you're good, but the second you stop and take a break, your body gets really cold. So it's kind of figuring out how to be constantly moving out there is one of the keys.
Dancing and being a good dancer really helps.
Yes. Oh yeah, you gotta have your break dancing moves on full form. It's pretty crucial.
So next on the journey, I don't even know how to pronounce that properly.
Yeah, well, it's Aconcagua.
Okay.
Yeah, Aconcagua. So that was the next up on the journey, the tallest mountain in South America.
Aconcagua.
Yeah.
All right, I've learned something today.
You got it. There you go. So that's just under 23,000 feet, 22,900 and so.
That's pretty tall.
Yeah, that's a big mountain. And at this point, I had made an attempt on the eighth tallest mountain in the world, Manaslu in Nepal previously. I didn't make the summit of that mountain, so Aconcagua was to be the tallest mountain I had ever climbed. And my climbing partner...
Second tallest in the world, right?
Second tallest of the seven summits. There's some other mountains like K2 and whatnot in the Himalayas and Karakoram that are taller. But anywhere else in the world, there's no taller mountains. Nothing close in North America, you know, anywhere else, any of the other continents. So, yeah, second tallest mountain that I climbed on this project.
A very intimidating name.
Yeah, and hard to even just say. So it's a tough mountain, you know, just to get to base camp. You're talking about climbing, you know, 20 plus miles just to get there. Some logistical things happened. I was actually ahead of schedule. My climbing partner that I was meant to climb with wasn't able to meet me there. And so I was either going to have to wait a week for him or decide to climb on my own. And so since I was kind of on the clock, I decided to go for it myself, created some interesting challenges, you know, having to carry all the gear myself and, you know, be out there alone. But getting to the top completely by myself, completely solo out there, was also an amazing experience and probably one of my most emotional summits. You know, got to the summit and just there's a video of me actually just completely sort of just break. I'm on top of this mountain, I'm top of the 23,000 foot mountain completely by myself. You know, no one I know anywhere near, and I'm just, you know, kind of crying and overcome with happiness and excitement and joy and maybe a little fear and, you know, a little bit of everything mixed in there. So that was an amazing moment. The Carstens was supposed to be the next stop, but we were ahead of schedule, and so we decided to slot Kilimanjaro in there. So actually, we did Kilimanjaro just before that. And so this was one of the things, you know, one of the logistic things that Jenna was amazing at, is I called her from Argentina when I just finished Aconcagua, and I said, hey, I think Kilimanjaro might fit here because we have this little bit of time and we're ahead of schedule. And it's kind of, you know, time is money in the bank for when you're trying to set a world record. And I said, hey, can you actually reroute my flight and figure out how to get me from Mendoza, Argentina to Moshi, Tanzania tomorrow? And then she was like, and get in touch with the people there so the logistics are ready for me to go tomorrow. Yeah. So she, you know, pulled a rabbit out of a hat with her magic and got it going. So we got over to Kilimanjaro. I had actually climbed Kilimanjaro in 2013. Jen and I had done that together. So this was the only one of the seven summits that I had previously climbed before this world record attempt.
How tall is Kilimanjaro?
So Kilimanjaro is 19,300 feet.
Okay.
It's not a particularly technical climb. There's only a little bit of snow right up on the top, but you don't need crampons or an ice axe, which you would normally need on a lot of these other mountains. But still, you know, it's a big mountain. It's the largest freestanding mountain in the world. It's not part of a mountain range, so you're looking at a 19,000-foot mountain that is just standing there by itself. So it's pretty, a really amazing place. And I decided to kind of challenge myself in a way unique to that, because before I had climbed it, and its normal amount of time is about a week to climb the mountain, so I decided to see if I could climb it in a single day. So me
That's right. I've read about this. Now, you were kind of a maniac on this mountain.
Yeah, you know, I wanted to test myself, and of course, it helped that I was already acclimatized coming from Aconcagua just before this. So, yeah. My body was already adjusted to the high altitude, which is one of the reasons why normally you have to climb a mountain like this over the course of many days to get your body used to the higher altitude. But since my body was already used to it, and I was feeling very physically fit, I decided, hey, let me see if I can climb it in a single day. So I climbed from the gate entrance to the park to the summit in just under 12 hours. There's so many things that can happen, you know, things that can go wrong, bad weather, bad conditions, right. Getting injured, flight delays. It was definitely a situation where I never felt like I could count my chickens until they've hatched. You know, no one had climbed even because of avalanche and earthquake in Nepal in 2014 and 2015. No one climbed Everest at all, either of those years. So I was actually, you know, setting out to climb Mount Everest in 2016, and no one had climbed Everest since 2013 from the Nepalese side. And so, you know, just goes to show, you know, how big of a challenge this was. You know, even when I was going out and talking with sponsors or trying to get people to help support this project, they said, what makes you think you can climb Mount Everest, let alone eight other peaks? No one even climbed Everest the last 2 years. And so, of course, I had a lot of belief in myself, but of course, in the back of my mind, there's a bit of doubt too, knowing that, like, there's some things outside of my control. You know, if Mother Nature decides to kick up another earthquake, you know, this project is over, and that's nothing I can control about that.
Yeah. Wow. And then Karstens Pyramid.
Yeah, so Karstens Pyramid was next, which is a big sort of rock climbing spire in Indonesia. Technically, because of where the tectonic plates have shifted, is part of the Australia continent in this challenge. And that's a really unique place. You know, West Papua, Indonesia, such a remote part of the world. You know, that part, some of the most tribal regions there, some of the least touched parts of the modern world, really. And so to experience that was incredibly unique. And that being so near the equator, was actually one of the warmest mountains, you know, relatively speaking. So it was about, you know, 40, 45 degrees Fahrenheit most of the time we were there, rather than some of these places I was were more like minus 40, minus 30. So instead of snow, it was rain. Instead of ice, it was rock. So that required, you know, some technical rock climbing. There's a part called the Terillian Traverse, which is this huge chasm, about 2,000 foot down chasm. And you have to have, there's these ropes rigged up between the chasm, and you're basically walking over air, suspended over air, you know, making your way.
Isn't there a video of that? I thought I saw a clip of that.
Yeah, there's a video of that, which...
You were a bit scared.
Oh, for sure. Of course. I mean, you know, I'm only human.
Man enough to admit
that. I'm only human. You know, looking down in 2,000 feet of air below you is definitely enough to get the heart pumping, for sure. So that was definitely one of the more unique climbs of the whole project, for sure.
And then next...
Next was Mount Elbrus, the tallest mountain in Europe. So that's found in the Caucasus Mountains in Western Russia. Mm-hmm. Really beautiful place. You know, I got to say, I didn't know much about this mountain going in. Of course, I had done my research on all these mountains, but it was one I knew probably the least about. And I was blown away by the Caucasus. You know, whether, you know, you're someone who wants to climb mountains or just experience nature, just this mountain range is stunning. And it's right on the Georgia-Russia border. And it was an incredible place. So, you know, set off to climb that. And one of the challenges there was that it was a winter climb. So normally Mount Elbrus is climbed in summer. But, you know, similar to how Mount Hood or Mount Rainier, a lot of these mountains are normally climbed in summer. But for the world record, to get kind of, again, keep the head of schedule, I decided to attempt it in winter, which means, you know, 20 degrees colder temperatures, a lot more ice, a lot more challenging conditions, winds, and whatnot. So that made it really tough. But fortunately, I was able to get there. And there had a big storm was coming in the following day, but I kind of got up to the summit and back down just in the nick of time before a storm actually closed out the climbing conditions for the next couple of weeks. So I was fortunate to, again, there's some luck involved here of just kind of threading the needle on some fortuitous moments.
Yeah. And then the North Pole?
Yeah, so that kind of kicked off the final third of the project, which I always thought was going to be the hardest third of the project.
And then you're thinking, okay, I got this.
You know, I'm two-thirds of the way done, but, you know, sometimes people say this about marathon running. They say, you know, the race doesn't really start until mile 20 of the marathon. And I kind of looked at this project the same, which is, it was one thing to say, hey, I've done, you know, six expeditions, only three to go. But the truth is, North Pole, Mount Everest, Denali, those three are probably the hardest three expeditions of all of the nine. And I'm towards the end. I've already been out, you know, climbing for 80, 90 days at this point. So I'm exhausted. And then to have the three hardest ones stacked back to back on each other made this really challenging for sure. So
Now you're starting to wonder why it's only been 50 people that have even attempted this test.
Right.
Was it 42 in a year?
So only of the Explorers Grand Slam, just fewer than 50 people have ever even accomplished that feat.
Okay.
Right. At this point, myself as well as three others have done it in under a year. And of course, I'm the only person doing it under, I did it in 4.5 months, but also the only person I've done it under 6 months.
Right.
You know, most of the people who's ever even done this have done it over 5, 10, 15 years, a legacy project. They climb one mountain, go home, plan and dream for the next one, train for it and that. And so to do that back to back to back. And one of the reasons very few people have done it in such a short time frame is because to climb the North Pole, to go to the North Pole and climb Mount Everest in the same season is incredibly difficult. So the North Pole is floating sea ice in the middle of the Arctic Ocean.
Right.
You know, it's
right.
There's no land mass under there. You're literally floating around on ice in the middle of the ocean, but you're literally at sea level. You're walking on frozen ocean. Yeah. You're at sea level. There's pretty much the closest definition to being at sea level as possible. And that first couple weeks when that expedition has to take place due to the weather is also the time when most people start climbing Mount Everest. So Mount Everest is 29,000 feet, and the most crucial thing for climbing high-altitude mountains is being at high altitude and getting your body adjusted. So being at the North Pole at sea level was the exact opposite place that you'd ever want to be while preparing to be on Mount Everest. So that was really tough. And then I ended up getting delayed at the North Pole for 8 days because the flights couldn't land on the ice, and there was a number of problems out there with cracking ice and stuff, so I literally couldn't get there. So every day that went by, I was getting more and more afraid about my chances to climb Everest. At the end, I was the last person in the entire climbing season to arrive to Mount Everest about a month behind the normal climbing schedule. And then I fortunately did summit Mount Everest a few weeks later, but I was on Mount Everest for less than a month. I summited in just more than 3 weeks from being on the mountain, whereas most people take 8 weeks to do it. And so there was a fear for me the entire time of, is this enough time? Is this safe? Can I do this? Can my body handle it coming straight from sea level like I had?
Yeah, lots of questions. Did you see the effects, or did you feel the effects of climate change in the North Pole? Do you think that's a reason why there was a delay?
Yeah, you know, I think that is the truth. You know, of course, I've never been to the North Pole before, but I was out there with a very famous polar explorer was lending me guidance out there, Eric Larson. And he, you know, he's been there many times in a lot of long polar crossings. And, you know, from talking to him, he's like, you know, the North Pole is not normally like this. It's not normally this volatile, this near the pole. The ice isn't normally shifting around. The Borneo Station, which is the station the Russians build out there every year to land their airplanes out on the ice, do their scientific experiments and whatnot, they've had small problems here and there, but never an 8-9 day delay with cracking ice, which a lot of people think, you know, is a result of climate change. And I would say, you know, in my limited experience out there, it sure seems that's the case. It's just that near the pole, you're already seeing the ice break up, you know, whereas, you know, certainly throughout history, that would be very solid ice. When you're out on the ice, you can actually see the different layers. You know, you can see new ice, you can see multi-year ice. Normally near the pole.
Multi-year ice.
Yeah, so normally near the pole, you would see ice that hasn't frozen or thawed over 10s or 20 or 30 years. It's very thick ice.
Yeah.
And there were points, you know, not far from the pole, like within, you know, a couple miles of the North Pole, where there was open water, where we actually had to go around open water. Like Eric Larson, who I mentioned before, you know, he actually at one point fell through the ice waist deep, and we had to pull him out, you know, out of the water from there. And that just goes to show, I mean, that's one of the challenges of the North Pole expedition anyways, but generally from what I'm understood, that normally happens around the 83rd, 84th, 85th parallel. But, you know, being up between the 89th and 90th parallel, usually that's really solid, stable ice. And as climate change has impacted the welfare of the planet, there's no doubt that is melting faster now.
So next is the big one. Yep. Mount Everest. My yeah. goodness. Time to break out some Instagram filters.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You know, it was Mount Everest, you know.
Some selfies.
Of course. You got to get the Everest selfies. There's plenty of those. You know, Everest always brings a smile to my face. It's an incredible mountain. You know, from a young kid, I always dream of climbing Mount Everest. You know, I read every book there was on it as a kid, just yeah. the you know, the history of the mountain, Sir Edmund Hillary's first ascent, right. and, you know, Mallory in the 1930s, you know, being lost out there. Just all the history of surrounding that has always just fascinated me. So to actually be there, I remember the first time I was leaving base camp and going up through the Khumbu Icefall, which is the very beginning of the Mount Everest climb. And like literally pinching myself going like I was actually taking a selfie, if you will, on a video because I recorded a lot of this hoping to put together a documentary film at some point. But I was filming myself and I said, oh, I'm climbing Mount Everest. And I like kind of stopped myself and was like, whoa, like I'm really climbing Mount Everest. Like this is really happening.
That's a big
right
sentence.
Now. Yeah. Yeah. So that was incredible for me. And the whole experience was surreal to be on that mountain, a mountain I dreamed of for so long. And it did not disappoint. It was such a challenging expedition. You know, I actually made an initial summit attempt around May 14th, and I was climbing.
I watched that video.
Yeah.
And you were delayed.
Yeah, so I got up to Camp 4, which is the camp 26,000 feet, where they call that the death zone. You're entering the death zone.
Because, death zone, that sounds yeah, pretty scary.
Yeah, so literally, you know, the human body is kind of slowly shutting down when you're above that altitude, so you can't, you know, I don't think many people have spent more than about 48 hours or so above up in the death zone. And certainly you're on your limit when you're up there. It's very, very much testing you. So Camp 4 is right.
What is going on with your body at that height?
There's just so little oxygen, even with the supplemental oxygen and mask that you use.
Even with the supplemental oxygen?
Yeah, it's just a huge toll on your body. It just, you know, it's hard to breathe. Your body is really having a hard time taking in calories, so you can't really feed yourself properly. Dehydration really? Is a major issue. Your body is just kind of slowly shutting down. There's no really a lack of better way to say it other than it's not, we're really not meant to be up there as humans, is
hence
the truth.
The death zone.
Yeah, hence the death zone, the moniker, the death zone. But you know, being up there, I got up there myself and Sherpa Pasang Bodhi, who I was climbing with, and had been a great day of climbing to reach Camp 4. Beautiful sunny day, and we turned the corner on this feature on the mountain called the Geneva Spur, right before the South Col, a very famous feature on the mountain where Camp 4 is, and all of a sudden we're hit by 50 mile per hour winds just right in the face. And we're so surprised because we were just shocked by this because the weather forecast hadn't called for that.
Yeah.
And, you know, got my radio out, tried to make contact with base camp because those guys down there had been monitoring the weather. And they said, oh, we've been trying to reach you all day. You got to get out of there. The weather forecast has changed. There's a huge storm coming in. And, you know, at this point, we couldn't really go down at that moment. So we set up a tent, which actually took us about 2 hours just to set up a tent because it was so windy and we couldn't even hold it up. And it was just, you know, you're up there, you're moving so slow, your brain's not working great. Scary moment for me and also a really emotional moment because, again, I felt like the project might be over. You know, very few people climb up to Camp 4, climb back down and have enough energy, enough resources to be able to make a second attempt on the mountain. That's not very common. And so, you know, turning back at that moment, I knew there was no way we could go up. It was unsafe for us to try to attempt the summit on that day. Just way too much wind, way too risky. But at the same point, as you turn around, the next, you know, I had to sleep a whole night there in this huge windstorm and then wake up and retreat down the mountain. I thought to myself, I hope this isn't it. You know, it looks like this could be over. And that was a really emotional low for me. So to keep myself inspired just to say, you know what? It's not over. I'm going to give it my best shot. I'm going to go back down. I'm going to regroup. So I went back down to Camp 2, try to get some good sleep for a couple of nights, you know, eat some food, try to kind of rest and recover, even though I was really spent at this point.
Where was Camp 2? What elevation is
it? Just around 21,000 feet, so about 8,000 feet.
Pretty high.
Yeah, I mean, that's incredibly high. You know, that's taller than most mountains in the world. So to be camped there is that in itself is a crazy thing, you know. Just to walk, you know, from the cook tent to my tent that I was sleeping in is probably only, you know, 50, 100 feet. And that would take me sometimes several minutes to cross that distance. You know, you're walking very slowly. You're moving very slowly out there because your body is so taxed. And so, you know, fortunately, the weather kind of came good a few days later, and I was able to make a second attempt and ultimately successfully reach the summit of Mount Everest on May 19th. But again, just like with this whole project, you know, I didn't believe it until I actually took the final steps to reach the mountain. You know, there was a couple moments when I was within an hour of the summit where I still was. It was so hard. It was so cold. It was so challenging. There was, unfortunately, a lot of people climbing on that day. So there were some lines and some traffic holdups with the ropes. And just, you know, there's always doubts out there. But hopefully, you know, you can, you know, get over those doubts by believing in yourself. Keep putting one foot in front of the other. And for me, I eventually reached the summit, which was, for me, it's an incredible moment. Something I'll never forget, reaching the summit of Mount Everest.
Summit of Mount Everest!
End of a epic day that I'll not soon forget. End of an epic week and expedition. Summit of Mount Everest today.
And now you're in the home stretch.
Yeah, you know, the summit, we always say the summit is only halfway. So first things first, like you said, is getting down safely. You know, 80% of climbing accidents happen on the descent.
And people die on the descent.
Commonly, yeah. You know, two people died on the same day that I was out there on Everest, both on the descent after summiting. The same day, yeah. So that really, I didn't know that at the time. There weren't people who I was climbing with, and they were on other teams. But when I calmed down the mountain, I found out that two people had died while I was up there.
What happened?
Just exhaustion, overexertion. Like I said, they're in the death zone. Exhaustion. So just run out of oxygen, run out of energy, and body just kind of puts, you know, the conditions that happen up there most commonly are pulmonary edema and cerebral edema, which is either your lungs or your brain filling with fluid, and that can happen for a series of reasons. But yeah, so that it just kind of puts into perspective how intense of an environment. And then also on my descent, a Sherpa climbing on Lhotse, which is the adjacent mountain to Mount Everest, had slipped on the ropes and fell and died as well. So there was a lot of mixed emotions coming down that mountain for sure. But one of the things that was so intense about the project in general was that, again, I called home to Jenna to, of course, tell her I was safe, tell her I was off the mountain. And I'll give her credit here for the fact that we set not just one but two world records, but she realized that we were on the verge of not only setting the Explorer's Grand Slam record, which was the record we had set out to do, the seven summits plus the two poles, but that the seven summits record by itself, so excluding the poles, was also within grasp. So that was incredible. But what that meant was she said, okay, you're back in base camp, right? Yeah. She's like, okay, so the plan was always for you to take a helicopter to Kathmandu and then to, you know, spend and recover a few nights in Kathmandu and then get on a plane. She's like, but I'm going to have to actually tell you there's no time for you to sleep in Kathmandu at all. You're actually going to have to fly to Kathmandu, get on a plane, and then fly 30 hours to Alaska via Dubai and then start climbing Denali if you want to break the seven summits record. So I literally look at her and I said, or not look at her, but I'm talking to her on the phone for the satellite phone, and I said, I just got off Mount Everest. It literally took me, this is not an exaggeration, it took me 1 hour to unzip my boots, take my boots off, and crawl into my sleeping bag. That's how tired I was. Just that simple act took me an hour. You're telling me I have to fly across the world and get, she's like, well, you want to break the other record, don't you? Yeah. So, yeah. You know, she's amazing and definitely inspired me to keep pushing. But that was a moment where I was going, I am completely exhausted. Yeah. So I flew over to Denali. One of my dear friends, a guy who I grew up with here in Portland, swam with and just known for years and years, a guy named Tucker Cunningham. He was on Denali, was my climbing partner there, as well as another friend of ours named Drew Pogge. And they had been on Denali for about 10 days already. So I was acclimatized from Everest, but I wanted to make sure that they were also acclimatized so that when I arrived there, we could all move quickly, as well as they had helped to, you know, prepare some of the camps and put some gear and tents and stuff already on the mountain to sort of aid in a quick ascent for myself. Thing is that the Explorer's Grand Slam record had been, I think it was 197 days before I set it at 139 days. So I was, you know, 50, 60 days ahead of the record at this point. But like I mentioned, there was a chance to set the seven summits record, which was 134 days.
Right. Okay.
And so I only had a few days if I wanted to set not just one, but two world records. And in a lot of climbing circles, the seven summits record is arguably even more prestigious, just in more people have attempted it. And it's been held by a lot of very sort of prolific mountaineers over time. The guy who had held the record prior to me was a guy named Vern Tejas, who I am friends with and admire greatly. He's the first person ever to climb the seven summits 10 times at minimum each. You know, this guy's been to the summit of Everest 10 times. He's actually climbed Denali 55 times. I mean, just a prolific, you know, guy in the mountaineering world. So to have a chance to break, you know, his record was incredibly humbling, but also inspiring. I was like, I got to go for this. You know, I got to try, even though I'm so exhausted. So we got up on Denali to 14,000 foot camp. There's usually one camp higher than that that people go for the summit. And then again, a super bad storm came in. Terrible conditions. We tried to wait it out for a day or two. And now at this point, I only had one day or a day and a half to break the record. Otherwise, I wasn't going to break it. I still had a good shot at the Explorer's Grand Slam record, but for the second record. And so Tucker and I wake up on the morning of the summit that we're going to try. And it's, you know, 50 mile per hour winds. No one on the entire mountain is moving. Everyone's hunkered down in their tent going like, there's no climbing right now. It ain't going to happen. And
50 mile an
hour we just decided, hey, let's give it a shot. Even if we only make it 10 minutes, we got to at least try. And 10 minutes, every 10 minutes, we'd look back at each other. You want to go another 10 minutes? You want to go another 10 minutes? And there was a couple moments when we literally got blown off of our feet into the, you know, the ground. Wow. The weather service was telling us that the wind chill was somewhere around minus 60 of that day. I had been had the same gear with me for months and months and months, and a zipper broke on my pants. So I was trying to duct tape my pants together while the wind was blowing 60 miles per hour. The wheels were falling off the bus, to say the least. A huge testament to, I think, my mental strength and endurance, but also I've got to give a lot of credit here to Tucker, my climbing partner. He was just like, we can do this, let's keep pushing. And I was like, I'm so tired, I'm exhausted. I was on Everest literally a week before, on the summit of Everest a week before this,
so
gotten down
help,
in this. And Tucker was incredible, you know, just, you know, having partners to meet me on this project that were fresh, that had that new energy, and particularly towards the end of this project, Tucker being such a great climber and mountaineer and just a dear friend, you know, knew how to push me, knew how to motivate me and, you know, keep me going. So that was May 27th, and you've seen the video, just like we kicked off the interview. You know, that was the moment that I reached the summit. But I think you can probably see in that video, the look in my eyes are elation, but like just pure exhaustion at the same time. I'm like, I can't believe we made it. Like, I'm just, you know, for the listeners out there, it's worth a view at some point on the Instagram account or the website, beyond72.com, of just this moment of relief, exhaustion, excitement, tears, perfect, joy, a little bit of everything.
Can you tell us what you're going to be doing in the future and maybe give some words of inspiration to others who might have this crazy idea to follow in your footsteps?
You know, the what's next question is a question that I keep getting a lot. And
yeah,
it's
kind of an obvious question.
No, it is an obvious question, but it's relevant, and it's something that I think about, you know, almost every single day. You know, first and foremost,
I just want to enjoy what I've accomplished, right? I
mean, you know, that's certainly part of it. That's certainly part of it. You know, first and foremost, I love that you opened this interview by mentioning Brian Gelber, but just the support that we've had around this project has been incredible, whether that's from Mr. Gelber, whether that's in the sponsorships from Nike, Columbia Mountain Hardware, Providence Hospitals, just amazing support that we've had on this project, and couldn't do it without those people believing in us. But, you know, not just the sponsors, but, you know, with Jenna, the love and support, family, like we've mentioned in this interview. So one of the next things is getting married, you know, getting married to Jenna. I'm excited about that this year. But the mission behind this project has always been greater than my own personal success. So it is about the kids. It is about that inspiration. So will there be another adventures and, you know, expeditions coming? Absolutely. Stay tuned on the Instagram account at beyond_72. There's going to be lots of fun content on there. there, and there's definitely some ideas percolating in my mind. But with that, it's always going to be a larger purpose for that, which is to share this story, to inspire not only kids, but anyone out there that's struggling with setbacks, that doesn't believe in themselves, to give them inspiration to literally keep putting one foot in front of the other, you know, to find your own summit. What kids sent me while I was on Everest, there was a number of kids from different elementary schools around the country that sent me small video clips that said, "My Everest is fill in the blank." And it was kids saying, my Everest is to be a gymnast one day. My Everest is to be a doctor. My Everest is to be the first person in my family to graduate from college. Yeah. And I think everyone can grasp that concept. In my case, my Everest was Mount Everest. It really was. And, you know, maybe that sounds silly, but like, everyone has that goal or ambition or that dream out there, and there's no reason that you can't attain it. And, you know, the lesson that I really try to tell other people, they say, "How did you do this?" is I had the big goal of setting this world record, but it was figuring out how to take one small step forward every day. When I was on the mountain, again, that's a very literal one step. That's literally one step foot in front of the other. But just in terms of planning this project, in terms of finding sponsorships, in terms of finding people believe in me, to having a great team around me, that's Tucker on Denali, that's Jenna running the logistics, day by day chipping away at that. So, you know, if you're a fifth grade student out there and your goal is to be the first person in your family to graduate from college, that means what are you doing every single day to, you know, get better at your tests, learn your spelling, your mathematics, grammar, you know, all that sort of stuff that's moving that forwards. If you're a businessman or an aspiring entrepreneur, like, what's the next step in your business that you can do to kind of, you know, believe in yourself? You're going to get a setback. Someone just told you no, you didn't close the deal. All right, are you going to go, you know, cry in your bedroom and, you know, give up, or are you going to get up and find the next contact, find the next meeting? So that's what I really hope to share with this story and share with the world, which is, like, as human beings, we're incredibly capable, and when we believe in ourselves, surround ourselves with the right people, and take incremental goals, you know, anything is possible. So keep dreaming big and keep going for those goals out there. Okay.